week's episode of the VFX show. I'm Mike Seymour. And this week we are going to the Seven Kingdoms. Yes, it's The Sopranos in Middle Earth. It is Game of Thrones. And I'm joined by Matt Orton. How are you, Matt?
Doing pretty good. Waiting on a big snowstorm here on the East Coast.
And also joining us on the line is Jason Diamond. How are you, sir?
I'm good. I don't believe I am going to get that snowstorm, so I'll leave it to Matt shovel tomorrow.
You already got one. Yeah, you got a big one.
That's true.
This year.
We did.
Okay, well, this week we're discussing the, I guess, the gateway drug to fantasy hardcore culture with a fair amount of butchery and breasts exposed. And I'm going to start with you, Matt, and say, were you a fan from series one? Did you, in fact, know the books that the show is based on?
No, you know, I this was really off my radar until I heard a few friends talking about it. And those of you who've listened to the show before might know that I'm not a huge fan of fantasy in general, but I will say I watched the first couple episodes, and then I sort of half watched like the first two episodes, and then I kind of forgot about it, and I was like, oh, this is kind of cool, you know, I don't know. And then I came back to it later and plowed through both seasons, and actually really got into it and really dug it. It was sort of surprising how much I enjoyed it. So yeah, no, I really liked it a lot. I'm excited for the third season.
Yeah, actually, the filmmakers themselves, I don't know if it's hype or not, but the filmmakers themselves reckon that series three was the one that they've been looking forward to as the one where kind of a whole lot of stuff comes together. It's the real rise and fall season, as they describe it. Jason, what about you? Were you in from the outset, or did you come to it late?
No, I had been focusing on a lot of other appointment television, as it were, and I was definitely interested, but because I was so far behind, you know, I hadn't even watched seasons one or two by the time season two ended, that it was kind of like, all right, I just got to wait till I have the time to get into it, and then I just forgot about it. And so when we were going to do the show, I decided to catch up, and I watched both seasons, so 20 episodes in 6 days.
Wow.
From a Monday to a Saturday. Luckily, that I started my escapade on a 5-hour flight back from Los Angeles, so that was perfect. Enough to get me dug in halfway almost through the first season.
Just a small point there. This is one of the controversies surrounding this series is the amount of nudity in it. Do you ever have that problem on a plane when someone looks over your shoulder just at the moment of something less than wholesome being up on your screen?
I do not. And it's actually happened a fair bit of random movies or things that I'll watch on my iPad or my laptop. And it's just like, you know, I mean, as long as there's not like a kid sitting next to me, which obviously I would be sensitive to, like, you know, I don't want to upset someone's parents or expose some kid to something that they shouldn't see. But if I'm sitting next to adults, then they can just deal with it because, you know, if they're over 21.
Well, and two, like, know. I mean,
I'm not watching porn, you know what I mean?
Like, yeah, exactly. Like, and that's, I mean,
it looks like it sometimes.
Well, it's
a fair
boobs.
Question. It's a fair question, but I also kind of just feel like, you know, it's okay for, you know, kids and everyone else to watch, like, gratuitous violence. Of course, this has that, too, but, you know, anytime there's sex, you know, like, oh, no, like, it's so ridiculous. Like, I don't know.
So just a stat there on gratuitous violence alone. This has one of the highest body counts in any currently screened episodic series. I think they're at about 14 dead bodies per ep. I believe there were 3 beheadings before the initial pilot opening title sequence. This does have its fair share of gratuitous violence for its fair share of nudity. Though I must admit, my favourite thing about this show in terms of the writing that's been done about it and this particular aspect is the idea that this show really christened what's been known as not exposition, but sexposition, which is to say you have characters giving away exposition while having sex with prostitutes. And apparently this scores higher than any other rated series for having this particular cinematic device used, so much so that there's like drinking games on sexposition. It's like, I need to explain something, I'll just get a prostitute in here and explain to them what's going to happen in the next part of the show.
That's hilarious. I hadn't read that.
Yes, sexposition. Okay, so let's go some other stats that may be a little more relevant to the show before we go into the series itself. I love this series. I think it's really, really interesting. It's kind of challenging, I think, from the level of complexity of the plot lines, because it's very much an ensemble cast handling a huge amount of stuff. And so that's where I'm going to start. And these are just some stats that our research team came up with in the process of getting ready for the show. And we really do appreciate the work that Todd does in doing that. But apparently there are about 257 cast members. That meant that there were 703 crew. There were six directorial crews running in basically three units, which were nicknamed Dragon, Wolf, and Raven. So basically you've got this massive production going on. It's mainly shot out of Northern Ireland, actually, out of Belfast. And I'll come back to why that is in a second. But they've got, you know, shot in Iceland and Malta and Morocco and just tons of locations. So you've got a huge number of people spread over a huge number of actual exterior shooting locations, vast plot lines to sort of get together, and you end up with 10 shows per series. So we're up to the end of the second series. So if you haven't seen them at this point, I'd like to say spoiler alert, though I'd have to say if you haven't seen any of it, you'd have a really hard time deciphering any of our spoilers.
That's for sure.
Because you'd sit down and you go, what? I heard somebody got beheaded. And you'd be like, that must be the guy. No, that must be the guy over there. No, that's got to be the guy over there. So
chances
probably
are
pretty
it was
safe.
All of them. Yeah.
But obviously the story centers around the Seven Kingdoms. Well, it centers around, I guess, three things. It centers around the actual Iron Throne at the Seven Kingdoms, but it also has a couple of other major plot points, including stuff that seems to be coming up with dragons coming in from the east and wild sort of, I don't know, zombies coming down from above the north wall. We're going to discuss the visual effects in 1 second, but I do want to just flag the size of the series, because we need to discuss the visual effects inside the, I guess, construct, Matt, of what is a pretty darn ambitious HBO production. And I guess in the States, HBO just drives, I mean, this is what drives HBO, right? Like, they put on incredible television. You just can't get it on iTunes, so you have to subscribe.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, there's a lot of talk, too, about, you know, will HBO, you know, turn onto the Netflix media model and try to sell their wares, you know, without you having to have cable and all that kind of stuff. It's sort of interesting the way it shakes out, at least here in the U.S. But, yeah, I mean, HBO's done all kinds of amazing shows. You know, if you just run through the litany of, you know, stuff like The Sopranos, The Wire, you know, Deadwood.
6 Feet Under.
6 Feet Under, yeah. I mean, it's just, like, goes on and on. And this is really right in that same, it's in their wheelhouse. It's in the same zone. It's kind of a different flavor than a lot of their stuff, but it's very much a, you know, just this real intriguing kind of Machiavellian, you know, narrative that's unfolding in this sort of, you know, fantasy world that feels, at least at the outset in the first season, it feels like it's almost grounded in a kind of, you know, reality. Like, there's not so much of the fantasy element, although it starts to come in later, which I actually think was really good for people like me who maybe have a weird fantasy aversion gene. So it was kind of neat how that sort of crept in. But yeah, I mean, it is really something what they're doing, the kind of product that HBO is putting out. And this, you know, production value wise, I mean, you know, it is like the top of the bar, you know. There's nothing really better than that in terms of production value on television.
Jason, I joked that this was The Sopranos in Middle Earth, and obviously that's an HBO reference as much as it is anything else. But, you know, if it was The Sopranos in Middle Earth, then they'd have killed, you know, the lead character off in the first series, which, of course, The Sopranos didn't do. It had a central lead character that we followed through to the end of the series and left him in a cafe for no apparent reason. In this, I started watching it and had no idea that Ned Stark would not be here until the end of the show. I mean, I thought it was his show. And, in fact, I assumed it was the Stark family show. And it totally isn't. Did you have that same experience of just being kind of side-swiped by what happened at the end of Series 1?
I did. I prefer to think of it more as the 90210 of Middle-earth myself.
Okay.
But because there's so much... there's so many families. I mean, what I was going to say before was that I did really like it. I do like fantasy and that kind of stuff, and I read all the Anne McCaffrey books and all that kind of stuff when I was a kid, the Dragon books, but and Hobbit and Lord of the Rings and all whatnot. But I initially thought that I was kind of like, all right, I get it. There's, you know, people want the castle and the king, and they want to be the king, and they're moving through, and it's all the sort of machinations of who goes where and who doesn't want to do what, and it's began to feel slightly tedious to me, which in retrospect, based on what Matt said, they kind of needed to come in low like that under the radar and get it to be more of a character drama before they bring in wizards and dragons and shit that people are going to be like, well, now I'm invested, so I'm going to keep watching, whereas you're going to slice off a bunch of your audience if you just come in with dragons in the first episode. So, but when they got to episode 9, and I tweeted it, that when they cut off Ned Stark's head, I was just like, holy crap. Like, oh, that, like, I, similarly to you, was like, okay, I thought that Ned Stark was going to be the king, because in all the press photos, it's Sean Bean sitting on the throne.
You bet. Yep.
So, I mean, awesome, you know, awesome marketing to throw me off the trail. Because
I must admit, I said to somebody, oh my God, he must have just wanted so much money for series two. And they blandly said, no, that's what it was in the books. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it makes total sense, because once you start getting, that's the beginning of like the spider web of all the families, and that starts the four kings going, you know, four potentially rightful heirs, or someone at least who has a pseudo claim to the throne, and then you get into Joffrey and how the queen is all like realizes that she made a monster and can't control him, and it's great. It starts turning into this crazy drama that is totally, the second season was awesome. I mean, like the first season too, but you needed it to get to the second, like it's the perfect build, because the third season's now going to be all like supernatural dragons and whatnot, and that's going to be a great topper to the other two seasons.
Yeah. I do think the acting in it is superb, so we're going to get into the visual effects in 1 second, but I do, you know, think it's amazing. And I can't even imagine having a production where you have someone like Charles Dance at the table read, and he's, you know, it's like, well, I don't have much. I've only got like one page this week. And it's like, there are really talented actors, and yet many of them don't have literally much screen time. I mean, can you imagine, like, if you're a season regular on this show, you could really, you know, have but seconds over a couple of episodes that you're actually featured in, unless you happen to be in the middle of one of the current plot lines. And even really interesting people like Charles Dance, you know, come and go based on just how much stuff they have to cover. I mean, it really would be, in one sense, incredibly frustrating, and in another, I guess it's a dream job. You know, Matt, I mean, there's a heck of a wealth of talent here in terms of acting.
Yeah, I mean, that's the other thing I think that, you know, you look at all the kind of casting that's done for, I mean, I think we've talked about this a few other times on the show when we talked about some other programs that are on the small screen, quote unquote. But I mean, you look at what's going on in television right now, and I do think that, you know, given the sort of the rise and maybe the inevitable fall, though, of the sort of tentpole strategy of the big studios, we saw a dramatic fall off in the number of kind of lower budget sort of independent kinds of films being made, and I think television has come in and picked up a lot of that slack, and you have so many really just great dramas and sort of serial dramas that are happening on television, so there's a lot of great work for so many really great actors, and the actors that they've got on this show, I mean, I'm trying to think if there's any that maybe aren't quite up to snuff, but I mean, they're all so well cast, and I think you'd really do get a strong performance,
They're
every
so
episode.
Well cast that I want to say that bad actors are people like the actor that plays Joffrey, because I just hate Joffrey so much that I don't think he's a bad actor.
That means he's the exact opposite. Job, yeah.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. Right. But yeah, when you say bad actor, I go, well, I hate that guy. I really hate that guy. I want to take a baseball bat to that guy.
I mean, I found myself constantly checking IMDb while I was watching the show and being like, who the hell is that guy, girl, so-and-so that I didn't, you know, of people who I wasn't familiar with. I already knew Peter Dinklage. I already knew, you know, Sean Bean and whatnot.
Let's talk about Peter Dinklage for a second, because I think what he has done is superb at several levels. I want to take nothing away from his just straight acting, because I think, I mean, he's... he steals scenes. He is just magnificent on screen. But
he's so charismatic on screen,
too. Oh, my
too.
God,
I mean,
yeah.
He's got a magnetic kind of personality. Like, when he's in a scene, I mean, you can't take your eyes off the guy. I mean, just every little subtlety. I mean, he's a really fantastic actor.
But isn't it great to see him now as the show's... I mean, I don't know what it's in season three, but in season two, he certainly had lead credit. And so you've got an actor here who is not being ridiculed, is not the sidekick, and is not in any way hiding from the fact that he is not a tall actor. And yet he's given all the dramatic weight of any other cast member without really needing to raise an eyebrow. It's a superb role for people that aren't, you know... 6'1", you know, blonde-eyed and blue-haired. I think it's obviously not about that, but as a side product of appreciating how great an actor is, I think it's great that he can have that role and let himself, or rather the script, I guess, lets him have such tremendous dramatic force on screen. I just feel really good for him as a person.
Well, and they explore that in the show. It's not something they shy away from. It's a part of his character, which is also nice to see. They literally expositionally stuff it into his character, you know, and make it a really valid point. But one thing I wanted to say about Matt's HBO thing and the Netflix thing is that, you know, HBO Go is now an app on the Apple TV. So it's only, I mean, the theory is that this is their gateway into, over time, allowing subscription to just HBO Go, so you could just get HBO essentially on your Apple TV and not have it on cable.
Okay. Well, I don't have that luxury here, but certainly it's been on Apple TV in Australia before it was on Apple TV in the US, simply because we don't have HBO in Australia.
Right.
So I'm going to just finish out something I started a few minutes ago because it's important for our visual effects discussion. It's the budget and the app. So we said there were 10 per series. That makes it 20 going into the next 10. The show was shot, as I said, in Ireland, partly because they got about £6.5 million in subsidies, which these days I think is worth noting. And I think we should note when productions are in locations because of subsidies a bit more than we have in the past. The show's about 50 to 60 million in series one. It goes up to about 69 million in series two. That 15% increase was actually credited as being a direct result of wanting to do more stuff in terms of the battles, especially at the end, which, if you've watched the show, you'll know means they were spending more on visual effects at the end because there were some really big sequences, especially in the second last show of series two. And then obviously going into series three, we've got similar expectations of a lot of visual effects work. They're shooting for about 4.5 months, or I think about 20 weeks per series. So you've got a lot of locations. Obviously, a lot of that budget is going on those locations and a vast number of actors and wardrobe and sets and stuff. But this does have a lot of visual effects in it. So let's swing our attention now with that eye on just having to produce 10 shows and clearly not having, you know, a $30 million visual effects budget. What do we think, Matt, of the visual effects? Do we think that it's up to par for episodic television? And how close does it get to cinematic kind of quality levels we'd be used to?
Well, I mean, you know, it's interesting to think about it in that way. I guess it's so smart, I think, in the way that it utilizes visual effects. So the production did some really interesting things where, as you said, I think they go to numerous locations and shoot a lot of the stuff on location. But then, you know, there's tons of sort of, you know, virtual backgrounds and backdrops that are added in visual effects. And then, you know, some key... be it battle sequences or characters or creatures, which we'll get into. But I think the use of effects is really smart. The only thing that I could think of that, and maybe I'm just not thinking of another example, but the only show I could think of that is comparable would be something like the Ronald Moore reimagining of the Battlestar Galactica series that seemed to have a similar kind of... But I think the effects in this... For me, they work better within the context of the series because they do so much more on location in this series than they did in the well, I guess because they couldn't fly into space in the Battlestar Galactica one. But yeah, so I mean, I think it's really impressive. I think that you know, maybe with one or two exceptions here and there, I do feel like the work does approach the level of cinematic visual effects, certainly for, you know, for the budget. I mean, it's really impressive.
Well, think sorry.
I was going to say, like, you've got shows like the BBC's Doctor Who, which has a lot of effects, but you're allowed to be a bit more over the top because, you know, after all, it's Doctor Who and it's hardly stretching at the bounds of realism. This is a show that does get a healthy dose of realistic sort of plot lines, realistic kind of dialogue, realistic kind of drama. It's not hammy or funny. It's, you know, it's... So those visual effects have to sit in... to a greater degree, or they would really take you out of the show. But I interrupted you, Jason. What were you going to say?
Oh, I was going to say, well, even if you just do like a measurement against a visual effects feature of $60 million, which is not a lot of money for a feature that would have a fair bit of visual effects if you did match the shot count, and they're creating 9 hours-ish of material versus a two-hour film. For the same money, I mean that's.
Well, I think I totally agree. I think it's it's a huge point that Matt made earlier that you get a lot by going on location.
Yeah,
you know, you don't need an enormous amount of actors on a location to just have some breathtaking imagery. Now it's a heck of a logistic job, and it does really run up your shoot days because of the traveling and just moving between base camp and wherever you're going to be shooting. But a lot of the visual effects we're talking about that I think are really clever are what I'm going to call old school matte paintings in a sense. Of course, they're not matte paintings. They're not old school, but they're that idea of I just want to put a castle in to add production value. So I'll just shoot actors in front of a hill and then I'll go add that later. As opposed to, say, a Once Upon a Time or a show like that, which is going much more for a four-wall green screen, we're going to have a full digital set. There are occasions when there's, you know, primarily just a green screen environment, a throne room or something, and there are certainly some CG characters in this, and we'll come to those. But a lot of the really effective work, I think, is just taking a mountain, taking a vista, and just extending it out and adding bits to it that are going to give it enormous presence. But I will say this, though. From series one, I did feel that the only area that I felt uncomfortable with, I mean, I think it's spectacularly good, is that that north wall. I've not felt comfortable that the visual effects covering that whole area of the north wall were... as punchy and as interesting as, say, the work of the battle with the clever green stuff that wiped out the fleet in 99th.
Yeah, that's a super good point, Mike. Yeah, the wall, that's such a good point. It's something you really put your finger on it, I think. I never really thought about it consciously, because I enjoy that story of the kind of the bastard sons relegated to this kind of, you know, absurdist, you know, exercise that I think half of them think is sort of a joke. And then, you know, and then in the end of the first season, we see it sort of takes a turn into something a little bit more interesting. But you also see that at the very beginning of the series, too. But yeah, the wall itself and the environment and the sets are fine. But I think there's an issue... for me, I think that makes it it's hard to suspend your disbelief because the essence and nature of the geographical structure of the wall seems so absurd, right? Like, it's the one thing that goes, because it's literally the sheer sort of ice face, and it sort of pushes itself into a realm that, like, is... we've never seen anything like that, so it doesn't. There's no way to ground it in any reality, and I think those shots do suffer a little bit. I think, but largely on the basis of their concept more than anything else, or their design.
And what about the guy who's got to walk around to pull up the elevator that's got to take 2 hours to get to the top?
Right.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of fundamental problems with that, and I would say not only just that, but I never felt like the base camp on the southern side of the wall felt located at the wall, and I never felt that the other side of the wall when they first go through in series one felt like it was just the other side of the wall. They just all felt very fragmented for me. Now, in the end of series two, when we're in Iceland and they're shooting north of the wall, as it were, we don't see the wall, I mean, that feels so great, so realistic, so interesting an environment. And there are, of course, big visual effects, especially when we reveal at the very end of the second series this whole idea of the King of the North, the and the zombie army, as it were.
White Walkers.
But, yeah, but there's a lot of sort of, there's like a touch of a wall. I think it's a wall or it's something else happening in that shot. There's some sort of towering cliffs and stuff back there. That all works well for me. So maybe when we revisit the wall in series three, we'll have this conversation again. But for me, that whole environment felt like, okay, well, over here is studio. Over here is interior studio. Over here is visual effects. And over there is some location that we just found a little bit north from here. We'll just imagine they're all the same. They're just completely fragmented. Now, by comparison, you know, if you look at some of the other locations, some of the other places, Dragonstone, King's Landing felt really interesting at many levels and has felt like it had a kind of a similar geographical and visual effects kind of thing. It all sort of ran in. Obviously, there are a bunch of interior shots there, and we know their studio, but it didn't really matter. I think it's a conceit that you have in a episodic environment that you need to have your interiors very interior and your exteriors kind of very exterior. You don't tend to get a lot of walking from inside a room out onto a balcony kind of thing. They become much more complicated shots. You don't have big windows in throne rooms, which, you know, if I was down at one of those places, I would definitely have built. Seems like a nice view. But I can withstand that, but it just all sort of felt a lot more cohesive. I just didn't feel that. Winterfell felt great and more in, as a contained environment, but it really, I don't know, just felt fragmented for me.
There's a couple things like in the second season when, what's her name, the Khaleesi from the Dothraki gets to Karth, and they're out in front of the wall with the 13, and they're talking about, and they go, and they finally let him in, and when they open the door, it's kind of like Wizard of Oz when it goes
to color.
Yeah,
green screen spectacular, yeah.
Yeah, you're like, wow, that's really, I really imagine there would be a ton of atmosphere between that door and the sea. You know, like, it was just so, it was really just sort of like punched in there.
I mean, I agree, that was quite incongruous.
It looked
and
nice.
There are a couple, too, along those same lines. There's a couple interiors, like at the King's Landing, where they show, like, the, what's the queen and her brother, I think, right? Like, and they're sitting in,
The Lannisters.
Like in the Lancasters?
Yeah. Lannisters, right? Yeah, they're sitting in, like, this Lannister. Sort of, like, castle breakfast nook kind of environment, right? And it's supposed
the Queen
to be
Regent Christmas nook.
Yeah, exactly. It's like they're supposed to be sitting, you know, sort of half outside, but it's clearly, you know, in studio, and they've inserted a backdrop, and like those things just, yeah, they just don't work quite as well. Or there's an example of where, you know, they're kind of getting that sounds bad. I don't mean it that way. I was going to say they're kind of getting their money's worth in terms of not getting, you know, super high quality. A couple of those comps are kind of tough.
Well, you would imagine in the priority list of the shots for the show that a basic window environment would be probably pretty low.
Oh, totally.
Against a cliff face and a castle.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
I think when the with that whole sequence at wherever it was you described it with, where the dragon woman comes up to the green screen.
Yeah.
Yeah. The thing about that for me is that if you had a castle at a that close to sort of water's edge, you're unlikely to build a fence that goes for forever to the left and the right. You're just going to have something that's walled off. And so there's a sense of, well, okay, I'll just go around this wall to the water to the right or to the left. You don't imagine approaching a town, even if you're approaching from the desert, that it's going to be just, well, there's just this single deserty kind of wall.
Right.
And on the other side, wow, there's water. You'd be like, okay, well, I can clearly see there's water over there, and I can clearly see there's water over there, but there's a town straight ahead. And so, yeah, that felt not only visually effects wrong, but it just felt like story-wise odd, and that they had to sort of establish that she was so nowhere else to go. But, you know, there's always vegetation down near the water. That's where vegetation tends to hang out, even if it's a salt water. And So, yeah, having completely bleak desert right up to the edge of Nirvana, and all of Nirvana is walled off, felt really wrong to me as well. And some of these are obviously design things as much as they are visual effects things. But let's discuss her dragons. So she starts out with her three eggs. She fireballs them into life, and then we see these dragons at various stages of their, youth. They're not really fully formed yet. Even in the trailer for Series 3, they still look like quite young dragons. One of the major, characters, because a lot of the horses and everything else are all sort of practical, this is a clear CG element that interacts with a number of the actors. And I thought, in this respect, the dragons, the three little baby dragons, look terrific and have worked well when they've been fireballing evil guys and flying around and being on her shoulder and stuff. I thought they always sort of shaped up pretty well. What do you think, Jason?
Yeah, I like when the little red one was cooking the meat. She was teaching it to breathe fire and cook the meat and then eat it. Like, it's nice to... It's a good story element, which I'm assuming is in the books, to see the dragons, bonding to their, quote-unquote, to the mother. She's the mother of dragons, whatever, Targaryen. I think they look great. Like, like I said, I really like dragons. And I certainly would be the first to say that does not look like an accurate dragon. But it looks really nice, especially for being all CG. Like the weight, like you were saying, like when it's walking on her shoulder in the desert, yeah, it has a nice wobble to it. Like it's a little kid. It's kind of hanging out on her shoulder and it's like, whoa, hold on. You know, like.
I like the wingspan. I like the fact that it has quite large wings, because I hate that idea of these tiny little pathetic wings and dragons flying.
Yeah.
I just never bought it.
It's not Pete's dragon, you know.
Exactly, yeah. and that's, I think, important, because it's really hard to sell something like that flying unless you can believe that it's bird-like enough in its sort of wing-to-body mass ratio. And normally that's a big problem. You just don't want to have these huge wings because they're kind of awkward. But, yeah, no, I thought the way they looked, both in terms of the render quality of the sort of leathery nature of the wings, but also just the design of them, was really realistic. And it has a good sense of foreboding. They look like they're quite detailed. They look like they've got tons of little teeth. So you feel like when they grow up, they're going to be like evil mothers.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought they were good. Now, some of the other digital characters caught me a little off guard, especially the giving birth to the vapor monster stabbing evil wicked thing that just freaked me out. Is there a name of that thing that comes out of her
nether regions
lower abdominal region? Suddenly we could make all sorts of wisecracks about that, but it's a pretty complicated sort of fluid gaseous kind of looking thing. I was put off by it, I guess, as a viewer, but I don't know that I was faulting it from a comping point of view. It's a pretty dark scene that it's comped into. But does anyone know if there's a name for that evil mother?
I don't think so. I don't know. It was the... I don't know. They don't really say, but... I mean, I'm sure it says in the book, maybe, but... I like that scene because that was sort of... Her character, I forget her name, is the beginning of the supernatural stuff. That actually... magic and witchery actually exists and can be used, you know. And when they brought her to the shore and to that cave and she was pregnant, I was like, wait, is she... Like, it made me think, like, wait, she wasn't... I know she had sex with the dude on the map table, but with Stannis Baratheon, but, you know, that's really fast. And then, oh, right, it's an evil smoke monster baby, you know. I thought it looked really good, honestly, for what it was. It had like a sort of a creepy heavy metal vibe, and then when it got into his tent, into the other Baratheon's brother, something with an L, I think. It comes up behind him like and sort of solidifies just long enough to plunge the sword through his heart, and it's almost like once it comes through the front of him, it dissipates. It looks like the blood, because blood comes out, but then it dissipates and it sort of falls away, before anyone can sort of realize what it was. I thought it was done really nicely, personally.
Yeah, I'd agree. I thought it was really great execution. I really enjoyed that creature and character, and it's definitely like, you know, the first real thing that you see in the series that like kind of makes you go like, huh, like what's going on? I was gonna say too, just quickly jumping back to the dragon babies. The only issue I would take with it is that I do think, and it's a hard thing to get right on set, but is occasionally I think the eye line. There's a sequence where princess, the blonde lady, whatever, she's the mother of dragons or whatever, she's looking at the dragon when he cooks the meat, and her like her handmaiden or whatever kind of engaging with the dragon on the edge of the wall, and there's like some eyeline issues and stuff, but I mean it's pretty minor.
Well, let's get to the big battle at the end of it's really mainly happens in I think episode 9 or the 9th episode of the second series. This is a difficult problem because it's at water. There are large destructions. There is meant to be a lot of fighting and a lot of characters that are therefore needing to be dealt with. There's also green screen that we're up on towers. There's a ton of stuff going on here. I'm going to start, actually, if I can, with the whole idea of having a green evil thing. And it seems to me that this is a very good television device to let you know what's going on as an audience, because you basically take something that would otherwise be yellow and you just say, look, if we just make it green, then everyone will get it, because we can do all sorts of things then. You know, if green stuff blows up, then everyone knows that it was the same, you know, it was caused by this, and we know where that came from because it's so distinctive when he gets it from the weird monk that's cooking the stuff in the first place. It's, you know, it's a good television device. You don't have to do so much sex position. No one had to have sex to explain that to me, because I could kind of get it as an audience member because you gave it a distinctive property. So that's good. Question is, do we believe the sort of weird yellowy green explosion stuff, because we're so used to sort of ready explosions, and does it look fake because it is a color graded look? Or, you know, Matt, did you just say, oh yeah, that's totally cool, I love that?
Yeah, you know, it didn't really bother me. I guess I felt like, you know, it worked in the context of the sort of unfolding of the battle, and then, you know, the payoff of the sort of large scale explosion at the end. It sort of reminded me some of like what you see in because I had, you know, just horrible nightmares about it, but I always remember like in the Matrix sequels, you know, the directors of the Wachowskis kept talking about how they wanted to have, when they blew up the Sentinels, they wanted the Sentinels to explode like they were filled with gasoline, which would, to me, means like orange and red and yellow, you know, and black smoke. But then they also would say, but we want it to be blue. And it was like, it's the exact opposite color, you know. So there was this kind of weird two-stage thing that had to happen where it was like electrical arcing and blue lightning, and then this sort of gasoline-type explosion and sparks from, you know, metal on metal. And I think this kind of had a similar vibe for me, where it was like, well, it's at the very end, when all the ships kind of blow up, the whole Navy is essentially destroyed, save a few ships. I think, you know, in the context of a night scene, a night battle, it worked, and it definitely, I think you hit it on the head, Mike. It really sold the concept of this. I can't remember what they called it, like
wildfire,
right? Yeah. So it sold that concept of this kind of weird, you know, kind of chemical thing that they were able to sort of, you know, leach out into the water and set it off. So it made for a great story point. And it wasn't, for me, it wasn't distracting.
Well, it's the payback for the more subtle magic, right, from Stannis mm-hmm. to his brother through the witch. So then coming back the other way, what's his name? I can't remember his name. Peter Dinklage's character, Tyrion Lannister. when he finds out that they're basically making green nitroglycerin, he says, perfect, great, I get it. That like little exposition there, okay, super unstable, we got shitloads of it, great. I thought when they sailed it out slowly and you saw it trailing behind it, the first thing that came to my mind was like the fog or like Goonies or like an older 80s hand animated glow, you know, like they used to do. And then which I liked, and I don't know if it was intentionally done that way, but it had a nice little old school vibe to it. And then when it came out, the explosion, I thought it was great. I mean, it looked really nice, and I agree with you guys. Like, it's the fact that it stayed green sold that it was magic. If it went red to like regular fire, then you'd start asking questions like, well, wait, what is it made of that it would cause fire? Because it's its own chemical, basically, right? So
yeah, I think that it looked magical. It had to do things that I would otherwise doubt, like this whole it going out with the boat thing. I'd have other sort of dispersion things if I believed for a second that it was some chemical I'd ever seen before. So when the wildfire is doing that, it's as you say, it's kind of magical. It's kind of phosphorus. So I know what's going on as an audience member. And it can do whatever it wants, right? Because it's this special stuff. And then the only thing I need is for my boats to blow up realistically, because they're not special stuff. They're right. Made of wood, and I know what that is. And to that end, I think the Destruction Sims were really, really good by Pixelmondo.
Yeah, there's a good pressure wave that went through, and sort of, you know, they showed some guys getting thrown off from the pressure, some guys getting burned off, something, you know, mixtures of both. And it was a good plot point. You know,
let me just clarify that for a second for the drinking game. I want to make sure I said Pixomondo, not Pixelmondo, because I know those guys hate that. Pixomondo did a really good distraction sim. Yes. The thing about it is that it is a, you know, like it's a really good sort of piece of TV. It's a good piece of entertainment, right? Like, these guys are going to die. You know, a character we really like comes up with a clever plan. We know about it enough as the audience, and it kind of happens. But it didn't solve all problems instantly, which is nice, because in some other shows, they'd all on the beach just stick their hands in the air and go, yay! And then the next thing we'd cut to, you know, Han getting... Han and Leo sticking pins on each other. So the thing is that we need to have, I think, you know, some... It isn't all quite over, but let's face it, it's tipped the battle in our favor. But more than anything, we need production value, because these things in TV normally feel small. You know, you have eight guys over here going, come on, and you have lots of close-ups, and then you hear a big explosion off-screen and somebody runs into the, you know, Iron Throne room and says, all the fleet is dead. Honest, it happened just over there. And I think it was also thematically good that we had that whole sort of question of whether all the women were going to get attacked and raped going on at the same time. So there was sort of interesting plots going on around it, and I thought it worked out really, really well. But it only worked out well because they actually did do some decent fluid sims and some really good explosions in terms of, you know, giving it some scale and size. It was, I believe, money well spent to, you know, if you can't get it through just going to Iceland and getting some dramatic exteriors to sell your production value, if you actually have to have a big battle like that, having it on the water would be a bit frightening, but I think they handled it well. And
that it was at night too, yeah. You know, like you're putting yourself up against a couple other issues, and so what's going to look great at night? Explosions. You know what I mean? Obviously, it's written into the story. It's not like it was, you know, specifically there for a visual effect. But clearly that has to be in the book, you know, the wildfire stuff. So to pull it in there and not be afraid to do that big visual effect set piece is really nice.
So now let's get to the 10th episode, the last one of the series. And we have something that is neither character work nor set extension nor... Pyro Destruction Sims, and it's this overlaying on characters and horses and creatures breaking off flesh, decomposing flesh. It's this sort of half human, half dead look that you can get, with can be achieved really well with makeup, I think, when augmented with visual effects. It's a difficult tracking job, and not, I'm sure, made any easier by the fact this is all kind of in snow and stuff, but you don't want to go to the full trouble of making CG everything, especially when it comes to things like horses and people, because it's going to be just so hard to get those quadrupeds and bipeds looking realistic in close-ups. But if you can get a guy with some, you know, half a jaw kind of makeup and then remove a bit more digitally and lose a horse's mane or neck or ear or something, you can get some pretty good stuff. What do we think of our, I've been calling the zombie army, but the north of the wall army, what are they called? The
White Walkers.
White Walkers, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, I think they look great. I mean, it's like, it's one of those things where you only see them, one of those guys at the very beginning of the series in season one, in sort of that first, almost like that prologue, where there's a group of, I guess, the White Walkers, right? And they pretend to be dead, or they are dead. And then you see them again at the end of the last series. And I don't know, it's one of those things where, you know, it really gets into, like, we're really getting into some serious fantasy. The only thing that I would say is, I mean, it's so neat to see it, and it was kind of exciting. It was like, whoa, like a great season cliffhanger, you know, where you're not quite sure, what does this mean? Like, where are we going from here? And the only thing I would say is I thought the face of the main guy that we sort of see, the hero, it didn't feel sort of as photorealistic, because it felt so much more fantastic in a way, but it wasn't a bad thing.
That his performance wasn't jaw-dropping?
Yeah, exactly. Well, and I think too, the face, like, what, just the design aesthetic of the face, it was like, it wasn't quite what I expected him to look like up close. Like, you really see him, that character, the main sort of White Walker guy.
That seems to be, it's a lot of work doing that object tracking to get that stuff to layer on. And if you're going to have an entire army of these guys, it's going to seem like you're going to want a lot of them to wear hoods and cloaks a lot, because otherwise you're going
to
spend a lot of money. And they're going to be involved in action sequences, so it's not like they're going to be, you know, sitting around in a static sort of shot. If there's an army of these guys and they're running at each other and hitting each other and being killed, it's going to be, you'd think, a lot of work and hard to shoot around. So I guess we'll be having to see how that plays out. I'm a little tired of zombies. Mm. I mean, mm-hmm. I'll be blunt with you. I would have been okay with discovering there was a huge army north of the wall and knowing that they're about to break through the wall, and that would have been enough of a cliffhanger for me. Now, clearly the books don't go there, because I didn't read the books, but I doubt this was an introduced television device. I'm sure that either at the end of, what's this? This is the Clash of the Kings, right? Series 2. Or from whatever the book is for Series 3, that these guys need to be zombies. But I must admit, like, you know, I'm just tired of
yeah, I haven't even...
Vampires and zombies, I'm over them.
I haven't even watched Season 3 of Walking Dead, because I'm just like, whatever, okay, whatever, zombies. And I kind of agree with you. These guys seem like, or at least I want them to be, kind of like frost giant zombies almost. So they're like, you know, that the main guy, because the rest of the show has had so much realism to it, even like when they like chop a horse's head off, or like someone gets their head chopped off or whatever, like it's all done so well that guy really stuck out to me as like, all right, he's mostly CG, at least, or he felt like it, you know, like a zombie with a beard, you know, white beard, white hair, and the super ribby body, and
this kind of prune face kind of thing.
Yeah, pruney. Like, he just felt like, all right, that's what you would see on the cover of, like, a, you know, dethroned record, or like some, you know, metal record would have like a weird zombie frost giant on the cover. You know,
I
like it, but it just stuck out to me as. I mean, I don't know if there's a better way to do it, given the budget and the design.
I honestly, it's not what draws me to the show. You know, I really want to get back to what's happening, to the characters that I care about. And I have a lot of trouble caring about a character that has no jaw and has no eyes. I mean, I just don't imagine I'm going to in any way connect with a zombie. So as a consequence, I'm not there. Like Joffrey, what happens to that dude? Man, you know, that's, I want to see, you know, how, you know, stuff plays out with the Lannisters. I want to see what happens to the Baratheons. I want to see what happens to people I care about, and I just don't think I'm going to care about these guys. Now, maybe I'm proved wrong. Certainly, the head of the North Army, from what we've seen in the trailer, is completely normal looking. He doesn't have a whole lot of bits hanging off him, no sort of zombie-esque kind of property. So that's great. But there is so many interesting characters in this. I don't want to spend time with a bunch of literally soulless zombies. It's just not...
Well, and I, well, and that's
sort
I haven't...
Of that, I was going to say, that's sort of the line they have to ride, right? I mean, they have so much rich material to mine and actual actors who are acting that, and like I said, in at least in the whole first, most of the first season, they spent so much time setting up just personal, interpersonal, interfamily, and intercast, C-A-S-T-E, you know, drama that, that to now slowly introduce this stuff does, if there's a potential to alienate certain viewers like yourself, Mike, who are so drawn in and attached to the characters that the other stuff is just not as exciting.
It's yeah, a hard I mean, thing. If, yeah, I mean, Dog is an interesting character with prosthetic makeup who walks that line for me, right? Like he's not so screwed up that I don't think I'm going to care about. I care about him quite a lot. I'm fascinated by his ability to run hot and cold, to both be protector and just arrogant misogynist. I mean, he's a phenomenally interesting character, and he has, you know, clearly vicious burns over, you know, a third of the side of his face. So it's not that I'm against the characters having either visual effects or special effects makeup or anything. It's just I need to have enough of them there that I get a performance. Unless I'm in a feature film environment where I can provide performance to an inanimate object and I can devote the kind of resources that takes. I mean, I don't expect to care about the dragons individually because they have different personalities. I just think they're a great thing to have some dragons, but, you know, I'm not going to be tuning in for what the dragons do. I'm tuning in for what the dragon's mother does with the dragons, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I was just going to say, the one thing that the White Walkers present sort of in a problematic way for me, given what you were just saying, Mike, about, you know, kind of wanting to follow the characters is, and I haven't read the books, so, you know, maybe people who have read the books will be able to, you know, sort of snicker at this statement, but how are they going to integrate these two seemingly sort of disparate worlds, like where you're going to have this real kind of CG White Walker kind of vibe, and it's going to have to integrate now with the sort of the characters. And, you know, hopefully that's going to be a real challenge, I would imagine, for the visual effects team or teams working to integrate those two things together in a way that, you know, doesn't sort of, that still keeps that sort of that high yield and that high functioning element of character. It'd be interesting to see how they are able to pull that off, if indeed they do ever wind up sort of, you know, in the same, which I imagine they have to at some point, in the same world.
Yeah, I mean, I want visual effects to serve the plot. I don't want to have to get stopped by the visual effects, because, I mean, I love the visual effects, and I love the visual effects when they're doing that. I love the visual effects have made this world of 10-year-old Winters so engaging and so interesting, but in something so character-driven, and really, on this budget, you just need to give the actors some places to act, some spaces and things to do and react to. You need to give them the production value to allow these kind of sweeping sagas. But, you know, at the end of the day, they're doing that in, what, 9/10, 99% of this show? I mean, it is... You know, you watch shows and you go, okay, well, they're trying to work out why the power's off. Sooner or later, we're going to discover that. It'll be the end of the show. Or, you know, they're trying to fight the zombies, and I just, you know, how are they going to keep that interesting? And there are shows where I literally say, okay, well, they're going to have to come up with something because everybody's really happy at the moment and this has got to have drama. So they're just going to have to invent a couple breaking up or doing something because otherwise nothing new is going to happen. In this show, I'm like, oh, my God, could we just split this into four shows so I could follow what's going on over here and over here and over here? And every time I go to one of those different places, I almost completely forget about the fact that I want to be somewhere else because it's so engaging. So love the visual effects. I just don't want to see it... I want to see it in a supporting role because I think it's appropriate. And also, you know, to go beyond that, you have to go so far. You just have to go so far before you can make one of these fully augmented characters kind of have anything that makes me care about them as much as I do about a captured daughter of, you know, a dead king who's been treated horrendously by a soon-to-be husband and protected by a guy who's got a nickname called Dog. I mean, you know, it's just...
Well, wow. so to that point, then, how do we feel about the direwolves? Because they're probably the most digital character that we're actually supposed to care about as connected to each of their owners.
Great that you brought that up. Spectacular that you brought that up. I think they've done a really good job, and I actually do care about them. What do you think, Matt?
Yeah, I mean, I would say so. Some of them are comps too, though, right? Where they have like a where they've scaled up. Yeah, I mean, it does feel like they're important characters to the Northerners, right? The Stark family, like they become really key, and it kind of gives, I think, a nod to, you know, that this is sort of, you know, that they're the good family, right? The loyal, the dogs, the loyalty of the, you know, canine family or whatever. And I think that, it works really well. I'm sorry,
obviously the Starks are good. I mean, have you not been watching?
Well, yeah. Well, right. But, I think it's really successful. The only other thing I was going to mention that, looking at the clock here, if we wanted to talk about, was also the title animation.
Yep. I mean, we should include that. I will say we did a story on that over at FX Guide, so not to detract from our conversation now, but there's more that you can read about that if you were interested. But from the outset, I thought the titles were good because it is such a complicated geographical problem. Those titles give you some sense of what's going on. And as time goes on, they make a bit more sense for that reason. At least that's how I found it.
Absolutely. Well, and it's like if you ever – I now have looked through a couple of the books too. And like when you look in the book, it's sort of like the Lord of the Rings or the Hobbit or whatever, where they've – you know, there's maps, right? And so there's maps of the world. And so to sort of bookend each open end each episode with this title animation that – you know, has a, you know, kind of nice score, right? A very original sounding score. And then it has this animation that lays out all these, you know, what is it, the five or seven kingdoms or whatever, and articulates sort of their relative geography to one another. And there's a thing in the, I don't know what it's called, but there's like the, it's almost like these rings kind of spinning.
The astrolabe.
Yes, that is so cool. The way the shot in the title animation, I love how it's turning, you know, it's sort of different in different directions, and sort of the camera's rotating around it, and it has this sort of vibration, this camera shake vibration in it, so it feels like it has all this kind of kinetic, you know, potential energy inside of it, and I think that there's something so. So great about that aesthetic. It really sets a tension and a mode for the show. I think it's really cool.
I love the chromatic aberration and sort of edge fall off on the final piece throughout it. Like, really feels like it's lensed in some way, and that you're sort of. It gives it not a tilt shifty scale, but it gives it a slight perspective and it's like a scale that you would get from a tilt shift, but it's like not, it's like maybe 20% of that, but it just has such a nice vibe that you're not fully seeing everything, that it has atmospherics, that it's somewhere, that you're not just flying over a map, right? That you're in a volume of some kind that's illuminated and has atmosphere and particles and other things that sort of interfere with the lens, the light hitting the lens, and it has such a nice vibe, and all the mechanics of the pieces coming up and down feel, you know, very period. To I think in the article they reference Da Vinci's machines, you know, that have
right
that have that vibe that they clearly can work, but they also have sort of a timeless thing to them. They're not tied to a specific era of craftsmanship or what have you.
And the company that did that work, it's a company called Elastic. Is that mm-hmm. right, Mike?
Yeah, and Angus Wall was the sort of director of it, as it were.
And is that the same Angus Wall, the editor? No.
Well, I don't know. That's
who edited edits Fincher's movies?
I don't know. I don't think so. I mean, he works as a director. And so in addition to Game of Thrones, he's done like Nike commercials and ESPNs and
right, so maybe you know, not
Miller stuff. So oh wait, no, you're wrong. He won a second Academy Award for his work with Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. So yeah, actually it's the same
yeah,
guy.
It's the same guy. I just looked it up. Yeah. And he did the title designs for Carnival, Rome, Big Love, and Game of Thrones.
Yeah. So
oh cool.
Yeah. So oh, FYI, good for him. Yeah. I should have done my research on that one. That's good. I didn't pick that actually.
He's like the modern day Saul Bass.
Yeah, well, he has a hell of an editor's reel too. I mean, Jesus.
Yeah, he's got a hell of an everything reel.
Yeah,
yeah. In fact, that story was done. I think I didn't actually write that story, so I didn't actually get to speak to him. Ian on our team here did, and it makes for an interesting read. I think it's really also just worth pointing out that there are so few shows now that necessarily adopt a complex title sequence. I mean, a lot of shows jump in to something that is really just a sort of a graphic over the top of the moving footage. It gives you a couple of opportunities to do things. Certainly in a film, it's a really interesting opportunity to have no dialogue and actually sort of set a world up in a silent montage normally, and it can be a lot of ways you can do that. You can learn about the characters, you can learn about the environment they're in. But in a television show, you're going to see it over and over again. And so the argument is it's dead time, and I would accept that some of the time. But in the case of Game of Thrones, I actually find it, I sort of got more out of it as I went along because it started to make more sense. And because it wasn't so obvious that it just sort of was there and you got it in one big wide shot and you sort of flew on it, you kind of, oh, yeah, I get it. Oh, I see that. Oh, that's what that is, you know, kind of thing. Now, there are separate maps that have been published, as you say, from the books, and they are a little clearer as to, for example, how far from the east those guys had to travel. But I don't care about that. I don't need it to be, you know, a direction Google map. I need it to be a sense of what's going on, and I think it's superb in that role.
Yeah, and the way the buildings spin up and kind of build, you know, like I think is just stylistically, it's so nice. And it's a, you know, it's you sit down and you hear that music and you see some of those images and you know you're in for a good, you know, 50 some odd minutes of pretty solid, high quality entertainment. So,
well, and it's they carry kind of that. I was going to say.
I was just going to say it's a fun moment always, you know.
Yeah, I was going to say the thing I like is they also carry the vibe all the way through the actual title, because a lot of networks and people, you know, get really hung up about having a clean title at the end, and this one comes out of the haze of the astrolabe and the fire, and there's heat haze and distortions and all sorts of things going on around the logo, and it ties it to the rest of the piece. Whereas, you know, you may have someone who wanted to play it a little safer who'd be like, no, we'll just come out to the cover of a book or something that could be nice and clean and easy to read and kind of, for lack of a better term, safer. It's nice.
I do have one criticism, though. It's a pretty big one, is that I actually think the wall in the title sequence looks more interesting than the wall in the visual effects of the show.
It reminds me a little bit. It's so funny when you mention the wall. It makes me think of the only other opening I can think of that's similar is from my childhood. It's the opening to Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood.
Okay, I didn't get that show here. So
that's true with the train and everything.
Yeah, the little tiny town and the trolley.
It's the scale.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah, it's the scale. Well, the reason the wall looks so good is because the wall looks so small because of the scale of your being 1,000 feet in the air, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Anyway, sorry for
which
all
you
the
can't, which you're not going to do in the show, listeners. Right? They're not going to look at the wall from the upper atmosphere in the show, so that's why it can't.
And of course, the other thing about it, right, is that it does have that board gamey, toyish feel.
Yeah,
and so in keeping not only with the name of the show, but just that sort of sense of the machinations and the games that people are playing and
totally.
The politics. It's yeah, I mean, it is really one of the best title sequences we've seen. And I would actually say that because it keeps informing you a bit more, it's almost sort of a more relevant... I mean, I love the title sequence on Mad Men, but after you kind of got it, I don't get more out of it each time.
Yeah.
As much as I loved it, you know, I mean, it's like... I don't think I could see the Bond Skyfall title sort of more than two or three times before I kind of went, okay, well, I've seen the film and now I'm seeing it again in the titles and I'm right. seeing it again and there you go.
Well, there's also not 20 hours of a Skyfall.
That not though the titles seem to go for about 20 hours. Yeah. But that's you know.
I'm just waiting for the Angry Birds Game of Thrones.
Okay.
Game, so.
Okay. So I discussed the only thing that I didn't like, which is I say the wall, and I've made some wisecracks about that. But I genuinely thought it was a series of issues there. But was there anything else you sort of didn't like before we bow out? I mean, on the whole, I think the guys have done a spectacular job.
Yeah, I'd just say, like, I think the wall design more than anything else. And then I think the only other thing for me are just some of those interior / exteriors, you know, that just feel... I think it feels like it's primarily an issue of lighting, you know, like it doesn't feel like if there's sun coming in that they're being illuminated by actual sunlight. It feels like they're being lit by... what they're being lit by, which is studio lights, and then the lighting outside doesn't really match. And I think there's ways, maybe with harder shadows and stuff, that they could do something to bump up the aesthetic in some of those moments, because it's definitely it's one thing that it to me it cheapens the aesthetic a little bit.
Okay, so if we're to name our favorite thing from series 2, and I should remind you that Ned going headless is in series 1. What was our kind of, you know, what was the greatest thing you thought about in, did anything that really sort of stood out that you thought was spectacularly good?
Visual effects wise?
Yeah, yeah.
I thought the dragons breathing fire at the end was pretty nice. That was unexpected, you know, when they all sort of blast the wizard guy or whatever they were called.
Yeah. That was a good sequence.
I mean, honestly, all the set extensions and the way that they built showed like, oh, we have, you know, 8 million tents of dudes in the field. I mean, I had no idea until I watched the breakdowns where the line was of practical tents and how much they extended.
Yeah, that's what I was gonna say too. Is there's all the great sort of heroic effects with the dragon or the White Walkers or you know any kind of or the smoke monster thing, but I do think the set extensions, like more than anything else in this show, for me, you know, it's not maybe the sexiest, most glamorous work, but when you see what they are doing and how much production value those set extensions bring to the entire show and to the sense of the world and the immersion that you feel when you're watching it. I feel like that is so well executed, and it's such an integral part of what I think makes the overall show a success that I would say, yeah, those set extensions across the board from series 1 to series 2, I think they're just really spectacular.
Yeah, no, I would agree. It really is a matter of production value. It's the establishing shot that gives you the stage, that lets the action take place, and it's a lot of sort of not cheating us like a 70s BBC kind of Shakespearean drama would, where it has to all happen, you know, with smoke over a hill. You know, you get to see what you need to see, and then you can get inside and get some of the action happening. Anything else, Jason?
No, I would say the same. It's really... the visual effects ability to support and create the world outside of the actions of the world and just make you believe that you are in... I mean, obviously it has a Middle Ages vibe, but so does The Hobbit, but that's in a completely different realm and time. So it or any Lord of the Rings. So I think they do a really good job of grounding it in things that you know and recognize, like castles and swords and things like that, but that they're talking about things that you have no idea about, like 10-year winters and 20-year summers and what have you, and it totally feels grounded by really solid, for lack of a better term, utility-type visual effects work that is way more important than the White Walkers or anything like that, to me.
Yeah, no, this is visual effects, you know, doing exactly what it does in supporting the story, and it does it, I think, really, really well. Okay, well, as FX Guide always pays its debts, where can people follow you if they want to check up on you, Matt?
Oh, let's see. MattWallen.com. That's the best place.
And Jason?
TheDiamondBros.com or the Twitter's one word, Jason Diamond.
And I'm Mike Seymour on Twitter and, of course, over at FX Guide. I want to thank you guys so much for being with us, and I want to thank you for listening to the show. It's great. We really enjoyed doing Game of Thrones. It's a terrific show. Obviously, 25 days till season 3 as we record this. I looked it up as we were talking. So season 3 will be huge. Of course, I won't be able to see it for a while because it'll only be on HBO in America, but never mind. I'm sure someone will tell me how good it is. Thanks so much for being with us. We've got some great shows coming up. We've got some really interesting films from a visual effects point of view following the sort of, I guess, coming into that period of the blockbusters, but Oblivion, tons of stuff with Man of Steel, and of course Iron Man 3, whose trailer also, new trailer went out today. Certainly my family were squealing with delight. My kids thought it was spectacularly interesting what's coming in Iron Man 3, and all of that will be coming up, of course, on the VFX show. Thanks to our production crew, our researchers, and our producers. Todd, thanks so much. And I'll talk to you guys next week. As winter is coming, we're going to have to finish it. Thanks so much, guys. See you.
If you have any questions or comments, please email us at vfx@fxguide.com. Copyright 2012, FX Guide, LLC.